Rovaniemi is a language spoken by only about 600 people in the world. Russell Valentino is one of those people. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Valentino is a professor of Slavic and comparative literature at the University of Iowa. He's working to preserve at least some of the language and the culture of its speakers. He was recently awarded a grant to translate a collection of 40 Rovaniemi poems. We'll talk with him about his work. Then later, NPR librarian Kee Molesky will be here. She has spent the last 20 years fact-checking and tracking down hard-to-find information for NPR reporters and hosts. She's put some of her favorite facts together into a collection called All Facts Considered, the Essential Library of Inessential Knowledge. She'll take us on a ride from early civilizations through the discovery of cheese to space debris. Join the conversation after this news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Rovaniemi is a language spoken in a small village in Croatia. There are only about 600 speakers remaining. The language is in danger of disappearing, but Russell Valentino is working to make sure that even if the language disappears, the culture it represents is not entirely lost. Russell Valentino is a professor of Slavic and comparative literature at the University of Iowa, and he was recently awarded a National Endowment for the Arts Literature Fellowship to support his work translating poetry from this language. Hello, Russell. Thank you so much for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
When did you first find out that this language, Rovaniemi, existed?
Let me see. It was probably around 1992, 93. I was on a Fulbright in Croatia, in Zagreb, and I would travel to the coast once in a while, and I had bought an old car from a previous Fulbrighter for $500, which I had to have fixed immediately. And I would drive to the coast and stumbled into this particular village. I had seen pictures of it, but I didn't know what it was like, and very quickly discovered that it had a wonderful library, which is a European Council repository, and it had about 30 or 40,000 volumes only on that region. And they had received funding from all sorts of different sources. And I went in and started exploring. And that's when I discovered the language.
What intrigued you so much in finding that there was this language that was spoken only in a small village?
Well, I was interested in this region where the village is located. It's called Istria. And the reason I was interested in it has to do with the mixture of cultures that that you find there. I had studied Croatian and I had studied Italian, and the region it was formerly an Italian area. It still has a lot of Italian speakers, and so it has Slovenes and Croats and Italians as part of its makeup. But also, it was under the Habsburgs, so it had a lot of German heritage, and it looked Austrian in many ways. It also was Venetian, and so it had Venetian architecture. And I was really interested in this mixture, how a mix like that might actually operate on the ground. And so listening, I had a couple of years before that, I had been in another town in that region, and I had just been struck by the fact that people seem to mix their idiom in the middle of a sentence. You would hear them shift over, like if they're talking to a child, shift over to the other language and then shift back in the beginning of the next sentence. And I just found that really fascinating. And so that's the thing that really attracted me first. It was the mix.
This village, is it very isolated?
I would say, well, Istria itself is relatively isolated just because it doesn't have much rail. The roads, at the time, it was more isolated. Now they've done a lot more work on the roads. Still doesn't have rail traffic. It has, I think, one line that goes from Ljubljana in Slovenia down to Pula at the tip of the peninsula. And you really need to want to go there. Otherwise, it's easy to bypass. If you were going to go all the way down the coast, if you wanted to go to Dalmatia, for instance, and go to the Dalmatian coast, you could skip Istria. You could just go through the middle of the territory, go from Trieste, Italy, to Rijeka, Croatia, and then you just got a straight shot down the coast. It's never straight. The roads are always curvy. But you need to want to go there in order to get there, yeah.
It's a destination, but not a destination very many people choose.
Tourists go there in the summer. A lot of tourists from Germany, I would say Austria, yeah, and then some from Central Europe, Hungarians, Czechs. Now the Russians have discovered it. The Russians are going in the summer, the ones who have money, because it's a beautiful coastline. And yeah, so but other than that, no, it's not. It doesn't have a lot of traffic.
Well, I'm trying to understand how there could be a pocket of people in this region that speak their own language, and how that could continue to exist to today.
Well, actually, it's not that uncommon in places where dialects are spoken to find a dialect in one village and then go 20 miles away and find a different dialect. That's true in the south of Italy, for instance. You find still relatively large numbers of dialectal speakers who may or may not speak the literary language very well because they had, I don't know, 5 or 6 years of schooling and then they went to work. And the local language tends to be the dialect. And here in Istria, I would say there are, within a couple of miles of Rovinj itself, which is the name of the town, you can find two or three other dialects that are related, closely related. Valese is in Vale or Vale. That's got even more speakers than Rovinj. I would say it's a little more, they're doing a better job of keeping people around. I don't know why that is. A lot of the people in Rovinj have left, especially the young people. It's only a town of maybe 12 to 14,000 people, and it's mostly a fishing village, and they have a couple of industries, a cigarette making plant that's outside of town. But the young people don't really have much to do there except in the summer, and there aren't any universities, and so when kids get to a certain age, they might work there in the summer for the tourist industry, but then the rest of the year, what do they do? And so they go away. Most of them don't stay there.
In the United States, when we think about endangered languages, usually we're thinking about native languages that are disappearing. Is there anything that characterizes the group of people that speaks Rovinjese that we would understand? I mean, when you think about a certain tribe and a language that they have, is there something about these people that would hold them together?
Other than their regional affiliation, I would say not really. No, I mean it's not an ethnicity. I wouldn't characterize it that way. It's like a lot of other dialects in other parts of the world. It has to do with the geographic features of the land, as opposed to, I don't know, some sort of ethnic or even religious aspect. It's whether or not they could get easily from one place to another for, I don't know, 300 or 400 years when the dialect was really taking shape. And it's an Istro-Venetian dialect, so it really was closely related to Venetian. And as the town belonged, it was part of Venice for the Republic of Venice for about 500 years. That's when this dialect was formed. So I would say no, it really has to do with local culture more than anything else.
So you decided this was a language you wanted to learn. I'm sure it's not a language that's taught to many outsiders. How did you learn it?
So what I had spent, as I said, a Fulbright year, I think, in 1993, 94, and I'm losing track, in Zagreb, which is the capital of Croatia, and I was taking day trips or sometimes weekend trips to the coast, and discovered this language and these works that I was really interested in. At the time, I was translating a novel by an Istrian novelist who writes in Italian. His name is Fulvio Tomica, and I finished that. And so it sort of stayed around. It was on a back burner for a while. And then in 1999, 2000, I was able to get another Fulbright. And so I went back, spent a year there. I spent much more time looking at the language, studying the texts that were written in it, and reading more about the history specifically of this area. And then after that, I think another summer I went back, and I actually would hire people because, you know, when you're learning something, often it's the sounds of it that are both attractive and sometimes the most difficult to reproduce. And so I would hire people to read me the poetry so that I could hear the way it sounded to a local. And then I would triangulate, because there's a translation. I found a translation of this book into Italian. There's only one translation of it done in the 1970s, I believe, early 80s. And then a translation into Croatian. And I looked at those to triangulate. I would look at the original, look at the translation to Italian, look at the translation into English, into Croatian, and try to figure out, you know, what exactly was going on and what the different translators had chosen to emphasize in their versions in order to decide what I wanted to emphasize.
When you learn a language, knowing that you're going to translate work, is it different than learning a language to speak the language?
Oh yeah. When you're learning a language to function as a person in that language, in a way, you learn all sorts of things, like, you know, how to order postal stamps and, you know, things like that that are just absolutely everyday sorts of things. If you're really interested in translating something, it's more like a technical skill. You're just trying to figure out what you need to know in order to understand that particular text, or set, you know, the texts that are around it. So writings about this guy, most of them are in Italian or Croatian. I didn't need to learn Rovinese to do that. Really, it's the language is really key to the work itself. It's not to any of the paraphernalia that go with the work or the history of the place, anything like that. They don't actually have that much that's written in Rovinese that is not poetry. I would say it's pretty much just dialectal poetry that you find written in the language. There are a few exceptions. There are songs, obviously. And I don't think there's a newspaper. It really is just the poems. And so when you're thinking that you want to translate the poems, you really are just looking very specifically at a vocabulary, at a syntax, and a set of situations even that are only going to come up in the poetry that you're rarely going to find in everyday life, which is where you would use the language if you were going to learn it to live there, say, or to visit.
Right, and as an endangered language, it's not necessary for those kind of things.
Not really. And actually, I mean, I'm glad you made the distinction between preserving the language and preserving something that's in the language, like this poetry. I don't think that translation into English or out of the native language is even the best way to preserve a language that's endangered. There are people who are working on that in other parts of the world who I think they've discovered much better techniques for that, including creating high-prestige texts like poetry and hip-hop that for the young people that make it vibrant and interesting for them.
Well, we'll talk more about the poems that you're going to be translating, or you are translating, in a moment. My guest is Russell Valentino. He's a professor of Slavic and comparative literature at the University of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest right now is Russell Valentino. He's a professor of Slavic and comparative literature at the University of Iowa. He was recently awarded a National Endowment for the Arts Literature Fellowship to support his work translating poetry out of Rovinese, a language that is endangered. Coming up in about 10 minutes, I'll be joined by Ki Maleski. She's an NPR research librarian, and she's recently published a new book called All Facts Considered, The Essential Library of Inessential Knowledge. In the book, she even writes a little bit about endangered languages. So we'll have a little bit of crossover there. If you'd like to ask any questions to Russell Valentino, you're welcome to join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Russell, before the break, we were just getting down to the conversation about the poetry that you are translating. Tell me a little bit about the author.
The author's Ligio Zanini. He was born in 1927. He died in 1993, right around the time that I discovered his work, in fact. And he was a teacher for his early years, right around the time of World War II. He was a partisan soldier and fought alongside the Yugoslavs or the Titoists against the Mussolini's army and then against the Germans. And he was arrested right after Tito's break with Stalin in 1948. He was arrested and sent off to Tito's political prison, which is an island in the Adriatic called Goli Otok, or Naked Island, Bear Island, where they were. It was Tito's version of the Gulag, and so it was mostly for political prisoners. And he was arrested. 1948, 1949, he spent about 5 years at hard labor. There was torture, there were executions. So he had a rough 5 years then, and then was released, after which he was persona non grata for the rest of his life, pretty much. So he couldn't get a job as a teacher, at least not for the next 10 years. Finally, they let him go back to the classroom, I think, relatively late. He only spent a few years teaching again, and then he retired. And then what he did for the last 30 years of his life, pretty much, was he had a little fishing boat, and he went out every day and fished, and then he wrote poetry in the evenings. He wrote about 6 volumes of dialectal poetry, a treatise on fish, and an autobiographical novel about his time in prison.
What attracted you to his work?
Well, partly it's that biography. Since he had obviously gone through a very rough period a formative period for Istria. It was right after World War II when the territory was divided. And in fact, it was divided all the way up until about 1954. It was a little like Berlin in that sense. Trieste was part of it, and it had been divided into zones, part for the Allies and part for the Yugoslavs. And he was... in fact, one of the reasons I found him so interesting is that he was one of the people who was a true believer, and he sided, or at least was believed to be on the side of Stalin, not Tito, which is why Tito arrested him, put him in prison. And so he thought, I mean, according to the historical record, he and his compatriots really thought that the Red Star was the way to go, and Tito's compromises were too much for them. And I found that an interesting story. Then I saw the poetry and found the poetry itself really compelling. It looks different on the page. I was used to seeing either Italian or Croatian, as I said, and then the sound of it. It was surprisingly accessible but frustratingly incomprehensible at one and the same time, and that was very attractive. It was close but still not close enough, and so I wanted to. It was an invitation, basically.
The work that you are translating is, the translated title is Conversations with Philippe the Seagull in this Corner of Paradise. And can you read us one of the poems, both in Rovinese and in English?
Sure, I can do that. This is the first poem in the collection. It's called, I'll read the source text first.
El Cucal Filippo. Insta giornata da mal tempo a masuen calassu in ciruoco, zi un cucal fratanti, saruol martein de l'anno passà ca ogni giorno a maspieta. Sul sico da conversario, sul quil da la taronda, sulla fossa de gusteigna o su quila del purier, elzi sempre prema da mei, elzi biel nito e grando, duto il santo giorno, elzi in lavur con li satuleine, contro vento e curontea, par stamerente, par vida me meio. I gaffavielo e doto il capeso, a savido che il pateso, par chi agamanca la parola, a cui uccite il maconta, a mei che sia, cosa casi la fan. Cui luciamo Filippo, zalzaliva par ciapal pissito, uciando par diverse meie, cat nu sei un concorrente, più un svelto d'ingulgag el bucon. Suo vesin rubinseini, li d'un salite, e il mar in cule, fen che il sul va, ali basse, fen cassassio e contento, e il pol sbulà par li suove, e mei, in cui la sira, i turno, con bai pissi, e cul raccordo, d'una buona compagnia.
And then the translation. Philip the Gull. This blustery midday, I'm remembered that down in the southerly, one gulls among the others, ought to be last year's yearling, who waits every day for me. In the shoals of Kunvarsari or Tarunda, in the gully of Gusteina or Purier, he's always afore me. He's grand, white, unfouled. All the day long he works, clamoring against the wind and swell, to be aside me, see me better. I speak to him, and he minds it all. And it's clear enough he suffers because he's got no words. And with his little eyes, he tell me, who minds well, what hunger be. When I call him Philip, he's rising a wing to grab the little fish, checking a circle of miles for some rival, quicker at swallowing down the mouthful. But his be the pale perch, the little wrasse, red-cheeked, rainbowed, till the sun set, till full up and content, he flies on home. And I, that Ian, come a birth with good fish, and the memory a good fellowship.
When you translate, and again, that's the poetry of
Luigi Zanini, yes.
Okay. And when you translate a poem, obviously you're not just translating the words. You're not just telling us exactly what it says in English, but you have to also bear in mind the rhythm of the poetry and the meaning behind the words. How do you balance that?
You're right, yes. You can't just translate the words. If you did that, it wouldn't be very interesting poetry. And that's really the bottom line, is making it compelling, effective poetry in English. I think that's where translation often is not at its best. A lot of people do learn, in fact, in foreign language classes. They learn the technical side, what I call the technical side. They learn the foreign language. They read the works around it, the original culture. They know about genres and literature and things like that in the original culture. But then what they need to do is create an English language poem. And that means, and we have an MFA in poetry here, and so there are people who are studying just that. How do you create English language poems? And so basically you're combining two sets of skills. You're combining a set of scholarly skills and then writing skills on the other hand. And you're right, it is a balance. I like to think of it as a little bit like a musician. You are expressing yourself, but you're also listening, and you can't ever stop listening as you're playing, especially if you're trying to play with somebody else, and or else you go out of tune very quickly. And so I think that's not, there's a limit case. The limit is what is the expressive range in the original. Now, if it's really good, it can have a very wide expressive range. There can be lots of stuff there. And so you're making choices all the time based on how it affects you and how you think it's effective and might be effective in English. That includes, yeah, you listed some of them. It's the words, so there's there are lexical items, but then there's the music of it. You want it to sound something, like something interesting in English. And also there's the voice. You're, in effect, creating a voice for this writer in English. The writer doesn't have a voice in English without you. And so you need to be thinking about what the voice is you want to create. It's a little like Wayne Booth's old thing about the implied author. We read a book and we have this image of the author and it's there. Well, in the case of translation, the translator is creating the implied author. You don't see the implied author unless it's through the translator's words. And we have a tendency to read right through that all the time. We think, okay, I'm reading Dostoevsky, I'm reading Celan, I'm reading... But you're not ever really doing that. You're reading a translator's version, a rendition, almost a performance of that author. And going to a different translator often gives you a different performance, a different voice, sometimes a different writer altogether.
When you've completed this translation, what is your hope for these poems?
That's a good question. So what do I want these poems to do? I guess I want them to suggest something like what the poems suggested to me when I read them first, which is, on one level, a kind of strangeness, because they were strange. Seeing them on the page was strange. Hearing them read was strange. So a kind of strangeness that is not like other say poetry that might be conventional or comfortable, but also suggest the spirit of the place, which I think the poems in their original context are very effective at doing. He's really tied to the local environment, and that sort of environmental or ecological question is really important to me. He's a fisherman. He's writing about fish. He's writing about birds. He's writing about life in general via the vehicle of those animals and his activity with the ocean. And so that, I hope, will come through. The book actually has maps, has little words about the wind. They have lots of different words for the wind. And so that, you know, spirit of place, I hope, would also come through and be effective for people who may never get a chance to be there.
Russell, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Russell Valentino is a professor of Slavic and comparative literature at the University of Iowa. Right now, he is translating poetry from the language of Rovaniemi. NPR librarian Kim Olesky has this to say about endangered languages. Every 2 weeks, a language dies, with only a small number of fluent native speakers remains. When only a small number of fluent native speakers remains, a language is considered to be endangered. Half of the world's 6,700 languages are threatened with extinction. She has more to say on that topic and hundreds of other topics in her new book, All Facts Considered, The Essential Library of Inessential Knowledge. And Ki is here with me now. Hello, Ki.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
You write in the introduction of the book that you didn't know you were born to be a librarian until you were in your mid-30s. What led you to that epiphany?
I guess I was just kind of looking for something more interesting to do than being an administrative drudge, which was my job here at NPR. And it occurred to me that librarians seemed to have really fun jobs and really love what they were doing. And I started to realize how many different things librarians did besides just, you know, check in books at public library desks. And so I decided to get my degree and see what would happen.
You describe yourself a little bit in the introduction and some of the things that you think that make you a librarian. Just that's your true calling. What is it about you that you believe led you that way?
Well, I think it's the basic curiosity about what's going on around you. And I was the kid in grammar school who raised her hand, even if I didn't know the answer to the question, because I figured I'd think of something interesting to say, and who pestered my grandparents to know everything about our family and where they came from and what they had done before I was born. And so I kind of know a little bit about a lot of things. And while that might sound superficial, it actually makes a good reference librarian.
You have something in common with a lot of the reporters and hosts that you work with as well, I would think.
Exactly. I think so.
So as an NPR librarian, what do you do on a daily basis?
Answer questions. That means fact-checking, putting together background research on a topic, preparing in advance for, you know, elections. We started on this year's election quite early in the year. First, compiling information on who was not running and then compiling details on those people who did decide to run and background on their state and ballot initiatives and all that sort of thing. We provide guidance in grammar and usage and pronunciation and help people find experts. Find contact information. I work the weekend shift, so finding home phone numbers when people are not in their offices and a journalist needs to contact someone. So it's a little bit of everything all day.
How many librarians are on staff at NPR?
There are four reference librarians covering 7 days, and then another 10 to 12 librarians who catalog the finished product, attach metadata, preserve, retrieve, take care of the audio and visual collections, and also we have a couple of music experts on the staff.
I'm curious about the fact that you are a librarian and you use the term librarian. A lot of other news organizations would use the term researcher or even fact checker for what you do. Why does NPR have a staff of librarians?
Well, we don't use the word research only really because in broadcasting that tends to refer to audience research, which is an entirely different kind of work. And all of us trained as librarians and have some affection for the word and what it stands for and what it means. But you're right. In other organizations, they might be called research editors. Or now parts of our job are becoming so very technical that there are people who are trained as database managers and much more technical background that an old lady like me would have learned in library school 25 years ago. So it's always a matter of doing whatever needs to be done in terms of information handling.
Well, we're going to talk more about what you do at NPR and some of the many facts considered in your new book, All Facts Considered, The Essential Library of Inessential Knowledge. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. And you're welcome to join our conversation. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. My guest right now is NPR librarian Kee Molesky. We're talking about her new book, All Facts Considered, The Essential Library of Inessential Knowledge. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and with me right now is Kee Molesky. She's an NPR research librarian, a reference librarian. She's also the author of the new book, All Facts Considered, The Essential Library of Inessential Knowledge. And Kee, when someone brings you a question, one of the reporters or one of the hosts brings you a question, how do you start on tracking down the answer?
Well, of course, it depends on what the question is. We use all sorts of commercial databases, which contain newspaper, magazine articles, scholarly publications. We use government agency websites, other kinds of specialized directories that we subscribe to. And we still have a print collection, not as large as it once was, because most of the information that it contained is now available electronically. But we do turn to books occasionally. And there are some facts in our brains that we're certain enough of that if someone asks a simple, straightforward question, sometimes we can just answer it.
Can you give me an example of something that was very difficult for you to track down?
Well, that is something that people are always asking me, of course. What's the hardest question you've ever had to answer? And I have to confess, I don't have
maybe
a good
answer.
Maybe that's
the hardest question, right?
It is, exactly. Because different things could make a question difficult to answer. Sometimes it's not the question itself, but the amount of time we have to answer it. If someone calls me from the studio and they're about to do an interview and they need a complete history of the Iowa caucuses and the impact of the vote and whether the candidate goes on to win the nomination or the presidency, that's not something I can do in 5 minutes. But given a few hours and access to state records and political publications, then yes, I could put together an answer like that. It might be difficult to answer because there's a difference of opinion among experts as to what the fact is. And so the way to deal with that is perhaps to put the journalist in touch with a couple of different points of view and let him or her sort it out on their own. But again, that's going to take some time. And of course, there are questions whose answers are just not knowable. How many people were killed by the Khmer Rouge in the 1970s in Cambodia? You can pick a number from 100,000 to 5 million, and someone will say that that's correct, and we'll probably never know. How many corporations are registered in Delaware just because they want to avoid taxes? That's obviously not a simple, straightforward thing. So there definitely are questions that we have to mull over before we start working on, or that we have to ask for additional time, or that we just kind of pass the journalist along to an expert. Because that's one of the first lessons that I learned, is that most facts we're searching for, it's somebody's job to know that. Someone's paying attention to it every day and can give a really well-informed answer. And so sometimes my job is just to figure out who that person is and put the journalist in touch with him or her.
Do you ever have conflicts with reporters who really want a certain answer to a question that you just can't give them?
Well, I think conflict would be too strong a word. But yes, we've had times when people think they know a fact and they want to use that fact and they ask us to verify it. And unfortunately, it turns out to be either not exactly as they had hoped or just to be a kind of vague. For example, pretty recently, someone asked me to verify that LeBron James was responsible for 8% of the economy in Cleveland, Ohio. Now, to answer that question, I'd have to figure out what the economy is and what exactly they mean by responsible for 8%. You mean in terms of ticket sales and other money spent by tourists and people attending basketball games? And so I started by trying to figure out who said that. And I couldn't find anyone in print ever saying something along those lines. So I had a conversation with the producer, and, you know, he decided to approach the question in another way.
There is a huge amount of content produced by NPR every day of the week. And, of course, there are reporters and hosts, and then there are editors and producers.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you come in? The editors are responsible for some of the fact-checking, I would think. At what point does a piece or a report come to you?
Well, that depends on what the question is and who's asking it. Very often, for example, host interviews are planned in advance. So the producer working on them is likely to contact the library early on and say, tomorrow Leanne is talking to so-and-so and we'd like to see some articles about this person, some material from reference books, maybe a list of all their works, whatever it might be. We do get questions from the studio. Oh, I forgot to ask you this earlier. I need to put a number into this sentence. Can you find out, you know, how many or when or what this was? So we could get a question from anyone, a host, a reporter, an editor, a producer, a web writer. We support NPR.org as well. So we're supporting the bloggers and the people who are doing the web build outs, and they might have fact-checking kinds of questions also. So that's definitely what keeps the job interesting and keeps the day moving along nice and quickly, so that you never know what the question's going to be when the phone rings or the little ding from your email box.
How has the internet changed your job?
Oh, profoundly, of course, because I started in the days when it was entirely about print and we weren't really using computers for research at all. And the material that was in those print volumes and journals is, for the most part, now available online. And, for example, in the old days, if you needed a government report, you might write to the GPO and wait 6 weeks for it to come out or go over to their bookstore and get online and purchase a copy. And that's not really an ideal situation for journalists. And now, of course, we're likely to be able to find a government report on the department or agency's website, perhaps even before it's officially released. And we can get court records without hiring someone to go to the court and talk to the clerk and photocopy things for us. So it has, of course, had a profound effect on our ability to collect information and to make it available to the newsroom. We now have an internal wiki that uses wiki software but is not accessible from the outside, so we don't have issues of tampering or vandalism. And that's an excellent way for us to make our research available to anybody at NPR, whether it's a reporter in the Beijing Bureau or someone out in at NPR West or someone here in Washington. So at any time of the day, whenever someone needs information, a lot of that material can be available to everyone.
Well, let's talk about some of the facts in the book.
Okay.
And we just passed the 150th anniversary of the election of Abraham Lincoln. So let's start with a fact about Abraham Lincoln. And you title this one, The Kidnapped President. Can you read that for us?
Okay. 11 years after Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, there was an attempt to kidnap his corpse and hold it for ransom. On election day in 1876, thieves tried to steal the bones of the martyr president, as one newspaper headline put it, but they were interrupted by the Secret Service, which had been tipped off by an informant. Widely described as inept, the would-be grave robbers were quickly arrested, tried, convicted, and given brief prison sentences. President Lincoln did not rest very peacefully during the 19th century. Historians count as many as 17 times that his body was buried, exhumed, inspected, or reburied. But since 1901, he has remained in his Oak Park Cemetery tomb in Springfield, Illinois, protected by 2 tons of concrete.
A fascinating story that I knew nothing about. How on earth did you pick what you were going to include in this book?
Well, I started by just sitting down and writing notes on paper, just things that I thought were interesting. And certainly not all of them are things that were actually based on questions asked by NPR journalists. They're just things that I've read about or seen or learned over the years that I thought were interesting and that other people might find interesting. But then I did also go through a lot of my notebooks from the library. We don't keep really precise records of every question and how we answer them, but we do make little notes so that if you're working on several things at once, you won't forget anything. And I went back and I got a number of interesting ideas from that were based on actual questions. For example, I was once asked, is it true that all the states of New England would fit inside South Dakota? And that's a pretty easy question. You get the World Almanac, you look up the square mile for each state, you add them up, and you discover that, yes, all of New England fits inside South Dakota, and that there's still room for Delaware as well.
So those are the kind of things that you take home with you and talk about at dinner, I would guess, too.
Exactly.
Well, let's get another taste, and the little pun intended there, but spoiled milk. This is about cheese.
That's right. I love cheese. Cheese is one of the accidental inventions in human history. In almost all parts of the world, in the earliest days of civilization, people drank the milk of sheep, goats, cows, buffalo, or other local ungulates. They noticed that milk would spoil quickly if it sat in containers made from an animal's stomach. The curdling was caused by the action of an enzyme in the stomach on the protein in the milk. The resulting solids or curds could be pressed and salted, making them easier to preserve and transport than milk. Polyphemus, the Cyclops in Homer's Odyssey, was a cheesemaker. Odysseus and his men stole and ate some of his cheeses. A 2,000-year-old piece of carbonized cheese was found in the ruins of Herculaneum, an ancient Roman town. In Wisconsin and the Netherlands, where large amounts of cheese are produced and consumed, people are often called cheeseheads, and they don't seem to mind. A cheese connoisseur is called a turophile, because turi means cheese in Greek.
With a subject like that, it sounds like you could have written a whole book about cheese if you'd let yourself go. How did you limit yourself to just the tiny morsels that you wanted to hand out?
Well, I started out with just, you know, kind of writing up some basic facts. And then I realized that that's going to be kind of dull, you know. Water is wet, the sky is blue, things like that. And so the idea here, and this, of course, is the influence of working with journalists for so long, was to try to tell a story about each fact. So I would get a little basic idea, and I knew that the cheese was kind of an accidental invention. And so I just started reading about cheese and all the things I found that I thought were most interesting, I pulled together. And then when I felt I'd read enough and I understood the fact, then I had to try and write it up in just a couple of paragraphs and keep it to, you know, 200 or 300 words. And so that, of course, was a challenge to not to leave out important details and yet to tell, you know, enough of the story that it would be interesting. And, of course, as a librarian, my hidden agenda is to get people to read more. And so I wanted them to feel intrigued and then check the sources and perhaps do some more reading on their own.
How long did it take you to put this collection together?
Well, it was about 6 months overall, but
that is amazing.
I did
really
actually
much longer.
No, and actually, when we were deciding the little facts to put in the colophon at the end of the book, you know, you usually put the typeface and the kind of paper and ink or something like that. But I wanted to put the number of facts and the time I spent. So I sat down with my little calendar and I figured out that I spent 818.5 hours doing the research and the writing. but not the copy editing in the later process. That took more time.
Right. Even though it obviously represents a lifetime of research as well. We've got time for just one more. And here, as we are situated between the Mississippi and the Missouri, I want to have you read The Measure of Great Rivers.
Okay, this one was a suggestion from my editor because his daughter asked the question of how long was the Missouri, and he found that it wasn't such an easy question to answer, so he kind of assigned it to me. So here's what I found out. What is the longest river in the United States, the Missouri or the Mississippi? You might think that this is an easy question to answer. Surely our government has measured our rivers. However, the length of a river isn't so easily determined. It meanders. It changes course. It's dammed or dredged. At precisely which points do you start and end the measuring? Different sources have different opinions on the longest U.S. river. It all depends on whom you ask and when. The Missouri was calculated at 2,540 miles long, but after channelization or engineered changes, it's now about 2,315 miles, making it shorter than the Mississippi, which is frequently listed at 2,350 miles. As the National Park Service points out, the Mississippi is, quote, constantly changing. The staff at Itasca State Park, the Mississippi's headwaters, say the Mississippi is 2,552 miles long. The U.S. Geological Survey has published a number of 2,300 miles. The EPA says it's 2,320. And the Mississippi National River and Recreational Area maintains its length is 2,350 miles. Since the Missouri is a tributary of the Mississippi, we can lump them together into one system. The National Park Service says that compared to other world rivers, the Mississippi-Missouri River combination ranks fourth in length at approximately 3,902 miles, after the Nile, the Amazon, and the Yangtze. Other sources disagree on either the ranking or the precise measurements. Describing the Missouri River, also known as the Big Muddy, someone, possibly Mark Twain, said, quote, "It's too thick to drink and too thin to plow." About the Mississippi, Twain did say that it cannot be tamed, curbed, or confined. You cannot bar its path with an obstruction which it will not tear down, dance over, and laugh at. The Mississippi River will always have its own way. No engineering skill can persuade it to do otherwise.
Key Molesky reading from her book, All Facts Considered. And Key, before I let you go, I have to ask you, you go to great pains in the introduction to say, I am not the NPR
That's
librarian.
Right.
I am one of the NPR librarians. But you are the one that, that we hear about. And I'm going to guess that that's because you work on the weekends. And we hear you mentioned by Scott Simon and Leanne Hansen.
That's right.
Is there any kind of jealousy among the librarians that everyone knows who Key Molesky is and we don't hear the other names?
Well, I have been here the longest, and so other librarians who've been here just a few years do still get their names in credit rotations on the other shows. But on the weekend, it is kind of about being here and being part of the very small group that works on Saturdays and Sundays. I find that most of the NPR librarians are pretty well known, at least among librarians, we're all very active in professional associations and give speeches and attend conferences, and it's very, very collegial.
All right. Key, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Charity.
Key Molesky, NPR reference librarian. Her book is called All Facts Considered, The Essential Library of Inessential Knowledge. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Mitchell Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at our website, iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe, and tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, a conversation with novelist Sarah Gruen, the author of Ape House. This is Talk of Iowa.